Say What? Say What radio show. With no agenda. It's always a surprise. But if we're not having fun, we're doing something wrong.
Welcome to the Say What show. It's March 7th, 2026. My name is Nancy Hopkins, and I am the only one here today, except for all my listeners. And I hope there's going to be quite a few all over the world. This Say What was set up to be like a bunch of people around a table at a bar or coffee shop or whatever, just talking current events and anything that comes up in the conversation. We've been here doing this work since 2014, so 12 years. And it grew into a whole station, actually. All over the world, we have people that actually have been listening to this for all that time because of our summation, let's call it, of current events. You don't have to get dragged down into the minutiae of everything. We just tell you what we're thinking and, you know, converse. Well, over the years, I've lost all my co-hosts, but I, except for Ani and Jan once a month, and a friend of mine, very good friend of mine, had gone to a social event. While she was there, she heard some people, including Jewish people, talking bad about Israel. And she is was born a Russian Jew, and after her family got to be adults, they moved over here, and so didn't she. So she's been in America for quite a long time. So she was upset because she really thought they were talking anti-Semitic. So she and I are having this conversation. She's telling me about it. And I said, well, let me put it to you this way. I said, there's a difference between being anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish and being against the state of Israel. So I went into a discussion of that and what's happening in the Iran conflict we have going on. And she asked me if I wouldn't do a show because she figured if I was helping her, I would probably help other people. So that's what we're doing here today. We're going to start with the Ottoman Empire. We're doing that because that's where the Iranian people originated from, Persia, the Ottoman Empire, that area. What you have is 4,000 years of history in a very powerful civilization that had their own brand of religion, you know, grown right there in their backyard. And for all practical purposes, it seems to be a successful time in this part of the world. And let me tell you something. I took Mideast studies in when I was at the University of Massachusetts. Boring. I found it incredibly boring. So I do not know the history of this world probably much better than you guys do, because I found it very boring. But I'm gonna do my best, okay? So I'm not gonna get into any of the specifics of any situation. I'm just gonna give you the overview of what happened. So you got the Ottoman Empire, Persian, their own religion, and then between the 7th and 8th centuries, you've got the Arab nations, but loosely, that's, I think, a loose interpretation of them being nations, okay? I don't know the history of it, who put them together, who got them going, but somebody got them all riled up. And they started, it seems to have been around the time that Muhammad died. Okay, that seems to be when all this religious fervor started developing, because that's when they began to move outside of their own borders and eventually got all the way to Spain. From Persia all the way to Spain, these people were bringing their Islamic religion to the world. It was not a religion that was, let's say, naturally accepted by a lot of different countries. But some countries did buy into it, and one of them was the what we know as Iran today. By 1736, this we're talking hundreds and hundreds of years that all this stuff is happening. But apparently, the Arabic ability to go that far only took a century for them to go all the way from India to Spain. So I guess for those days, they were really, progressing rapidly. Okay, so you got the invasion of the Islamics. By 1736, Shia Islam, which is a type of justice, a type of looking at things, the thing that is really, really not what Western legal, cultural, society, religion would agree to. To me, the bottom line is they don't follow the Ten Commandments. That's kind of the way that I think about it in my mind. That became the Shia Islam became the in 1736 the accepted religion in what is now Iran. It's one of those situations that I guess you had to be there to go through it, but their naturally grown religion could not withstand the spiritual fervor that was being presented by these Arabs. So you get you get a situation where by that time you got the Shah of Iran. That's like, think in terms of 1925 time frame, okay? You got the Shah of Iran. And the Shah is trying to modernize his people. And I don't know all the ramifications of it, but there were a lot of people that did not like what the Shah was doing. So that's when you, by the time you get to 1979, the people are in revolution, and it ends up being what we have now, the Islamic Republic of Iran. That's what we how we got that situation occurring. So, and I remember I was around when the Shah got thrown out. I didn't know where Iran was or anything. I was just a kid, basically. Well, I wasn't a kid, but I wasn't overly interested in it. And it began to be very anti. Well, part of the problem was that because of the religion that had been accepted, adopted, it was very anti-Western and very anti-modernization. And that seems to be the triggering thing in the people themselves that allowed the Islamic Republic to grow out of it. Okay, so that's the scenario in Iran. Throughout this entire area of the Arab area, you had a bunch of nomadic tribes. Yes, you had certain civilizations that got together fairly early, but there was a tremendous number of just nomadic tribes. Even in Saudi Arabia, there were a lot of tribes. I don't know how they got so many of them to go into the, conquer the world thing way back when, But by the time you get to the modern times, you've got these tribes who have come together to create a nation. And that's basically what you got in Saudi Arabia. I think it's the same way in, like the UAE, United Arab Emirates. What are they all? Even Syria, all those countries over there, okay? They started out as tribes. So when I took this Middle East course, I had to write a paper. And I don't know why I chose this subject, but it was the Balfour Declaration, November 2nd, 1917. This was World War I time frame. Now, the British had gained the rights to, I mean, they had a, they were overseeing, they conquered or whatever, the area that we know now as Palestine, Israel, and other areas were also, brought into it. I don't, I again, I'm just not looking at it that way, but the you got the whole area, start India even came under British rule, that whole episode in civilization. Well, when they get to 1917, and they were in a world war, they needed the support of people in Europe. So they start working with the a Zionist movement, which was, there was a lot of anti-Semitism. Now, Israel doesn't exist at this point, so it was anti-Semitism that was very detrimental to the Jewish people in Europe. So the Zionist movement comes out of that. And if you research Zionist movement on the conspiracy channels, you'll find that this is a very deep, dark. Maybe the Zionist movement was a front for, the deep, dark black state. But I'm not going to get into that either, because there's a lot of information out there that you can look up yourself and make your own determination of what's what. But the reason Zionists become important is that a lot of times you'll hear Israeli Jews being called Zionist. And some of them are irate. It's an insult. Whereas others, yes, in fact, they are. So the concept of Zionist is still a prevalent movement, a prevalent, let's say, aspect to Israel. Well, I don't know what the Zionists did, but they sure did piss off the rest of the world. So when you hear all of this anti-Israel, it's not necessarily anti-Semitic, but there's a lot of people that have a lot of grief about a lot of things. Let me put it to you that way. Okay, so we've got a situation where the British are at war, need the backing of the Jewish Zionists. And they say, well, we'll get them to come over and support us, because we're going to promise that we're going to allow them to go back to their homeland. This was part of the Zionist mission, go back to Palestine, Israel area, go back to their homeland. That we're going to support that because the British had control over that area. And that's exactly what you got. And on November 2nd, 1917, the British made a declaration, and it's called the Balfour Document. And it stated, yeah, we're going to give this area to the Jewish people. All right. That really pissed off the Arabs, because the British had been promising the Arabs to have, to be independent of Great Britain, basically. Oh, we're going to let you go, So they were promising them so that they would help in the war effort. Now they promised the Jews to bring them into the same area, and the Arabs didn't want that at all. That's where you get the conflict before the State of Israel is ever even instituted, is the entire way that deceit and lying by the British. I mean, it was probably going to be there anyway, the animosity. But from a legal standpoint, this is why you know it's our homeland. We own it, you know, the Palestinians. And they didn't even have a nation or a state. They were nomadic people. And the Jews believed that that was their homeland. So that's where you get the situation of Palestine. And then it gets a, it was so murky, there was so much chaos going on that the UN got involved in it. Now, that was in 1947. They agreed to a partitioning between Israel and Palestine. That was 1947. Now they've already gone through World War I and they're already through World War II when this declaration was, well, the UN was formed after World War II, so it was one of the first things they did, screwed that up good. So they basically, you know, just we're going to take this area, the Jews can live there, the Palestinians can live there, and well, it was an Arab tribe, you know, can live there, and everything will be fine. Well, then in 1948, the Jewish settlers that were there under David Ben-Gurion decided to proclaim the State of Israel. So at this moment, the Jews stood up and said, screw you all, we're our own state. We've got the land because we've got enough people in here that we're in control. And that's the way it laid out. By 1925, before this even happened in 47, the Shah of Iran was in power. Then we flash forward to 1979, and by then the Israel and the Arab world have been at war since 47, 48, even before that. So they're all in turmoil, you know, have been, still are. But you have the Shah there. And the rapid, more, you know, modernization. And then you've got an Islamic Republic that's being controlled by religious fanatics. These religious fanatics, I don't, again, I can, okay, I can give you reasons why they don't like the Jewish people, but I don't know why they don't like me. I don't remember doing anything to them. But they are continually talking about the great Satan, America, and the small Satan, little Satan, Israel, that they've got to be taken off the face of the earth. That's seems to be their reason for existing. I can't, it's, you know, it's kind of, I can make up stories all the time, but trying to figure out this story is like, why? What did we do to you? And maybe we did something and I don't know it. I don't know. But boy, they sure don't like us. So from the minute that they took power in, you know, 1979, within days, a group of students supposedly stormed the US embassy and took the people in there hostage. And they kept them for I don't remember how many years. I just don't. But the idea is that from the very establishment of this nation, they were attacking Americans. And if you go back and you look at how many Americans, thousands of them, have died over the time that this Islamic Republic has been around, thousands of them. And nobody did anything. Nobody did anything. Yes, they finally got the prisoners out, there was no penalty for it. Oh yeah, take them out. Ronald Reagan got in. Oh yeah, you can have them. It's like, if you try to make sense out of this, you probably go crazy. I'm sure there's people out there that have been crazy by this thing. So now you get into modern times. And this is what I need to focus on, is the fact that you've got Iran under the Islamic crazy people. I mean, when I say that, I'm not talking about any kind of religion except the people themselves. When 9/11 happened and the towers got taken down, right from the get-go, I didn't believe the story because I didn't think the story held up under when you looked at it, because you're saying you want dozens of people to commit suicide, take over the plane, and then crash it. I just couldn't imagine that many people deciding on suicide. Nowadays, every dick, a bunch of people out there, they're always killing themselves. Because I didn't realize, let's say, the hypnotic control that that religion has on people, and probably other religions. I just, been a free thinker, basically. But this one is tells people that, if you commit suicide in the name of Allah, then you'll go to their heaven. It didn't make any sense to me, but now I have to accept that it's true. There's a lot of people that don't have a feeling for who they are. They don't have a feeling of being directly connected to God, that will take in this idea that your survival depends on you killing people. I still can't get my head wrapped around it. I've been listening to the news on what's happened here. If you, as a military person, I'm shocked and awed what they've been able to do. I had no idea they had that much firepower. I really didn't. The advancements in the weaponry and the way they guide it and stuff, yes, I was aware of that. But they have dumped a lot of stuff on that country. Not, and by they, I mean the Americans and the Israelis. When you look at the way that the operation took off, it was, yes, they were ready to do it. They were going to do this. Because when Midnight Hammer happened and they took out the major facilities for the creation of a nuclear bomb, everybody sort of sat back and said, oh yeah, it's been decimated. They're not going to try this again. And don't you know, almost immediately, they started to do the same thing. And they just, it was like Midnight Hammer never happened. Oh, well, let's clean this up. Let's get what we can get and let's rebuild. Strange. I mean, it just didn't kind of match common sense or your own feeling of security. So now the president is looking at this country and he knows that all they've ever said they wanted to do was kill Americans and kill the Israelis. He's not going to let that happen. He believes that this is what they're, they're serious about this. And this crazy targeting of let's get the nukes so that we can nuke everybody. Again, they would have been nuked too, because everybody that had a nuke pointed at them from Iran would point their nukes at Iran. This was a doomsday thing. This was a death cult. So you want death to America and death to Israel, but you don't mind dying? Now I believe it, because of the people that are committing suicide seemingly by the hundreds. I don't understand it. I don't think it's human. I just don't understand it. But that was where Trump was. Oh my God, I got really crazy people. And one time I asked Ani Avedisian, and I said, I don't feel comfortable, no matter what somebody does, to just kill them. I don't know that I have the right to do that. And she said, there are some people that are so evil that even though they're not in power, the energy of their evil permeates the world. Sometimes you have to make a hard decision to get rid of them, because it's the only way you survive. Otherwise, you've got a cancer lingering throughout the world. And I thought, well, yeah, maybe that's true. Maybe to be a really good person, you have to do some very hard things. And that's what I see that Trump doing. We had a lot of other presidents that just, well, they call it kick the can down the road. They wouldn't deal with what they were seeing, what they knew they should do. They just kept kicking it down the road. Trump couldn't do that because they were, people say, well, why was it so imminent? It was imminent because they were building out their missiles. When they went in for the nighttime operation, they were after the nuclear stuff. They weren't after the missiles. And then you find out that, well, not only do they have missiles, but they've got some very sophisticated drones. Those weren't the targets either. Midnight Hammer was looking at nukes. This time they realized that they had to make sure that this umbrella of missiles this umbrella of missiles and drones was getting to a point where it would be very, very difficult, if possible, to take those weapons down to get the nukes again. So you have no decision making here as far as a military decision. You have to go in, you have to get rid of those missiles, you have to get rid of the drones, you have to get rid of the nuclear capability, period. But Trump kept holding on and wanted to, get them to come around to his way of thinking, because he's a logical man, he's a businessman, and if this makes sense and it looks like you're going to make money at it, why wouldn't you? It was probably a head twister for him to realize, no, they just really want to kill you, no matter what. So he gives him a chance at, getting together and making some kind of a deal that everybody can live with. I suspect he didn't think that was possible, but he went through it anyway. Well, the guy that was, there were two men that went to meetings with the Iranians. So the Mideast envoy, Witkoff, was on one of the shows. I was listening to him, and he said that when they started to negotiate, the Iranians said to him, just came out and said it was like bragging. He said it was like they were bragging. And what the Iranians were saying was that we have enough weapons-grade uranium to create 11 nuclear bombs. 11. Said it while they were trying to negotiate. And that was in the first meeting. I think that sealed the deal. And the rest of the time, the Iranians were playing waste your time thing. And I think the Americans were just keeping it preoccupied as they built out their arsenal, because at that point, you've got no decision. None whatsoever. You've got to take that out. And to take that out, you have to take the missiles out. To take the missiles out, you can do strategic bombing, but the key to the missiles is your command and control. So Trump had given him 10 days, a minimum of 10 days before he was going to take action. But he acted on the ninth day. The Ayatollah and something like 49 leaders of the regime met together unprotected, essentially, for breakfast on the ninth day. Underneath this meeting hall thing that they were in was a fortified bunker. If they had been in the bunker, they'd probably still be alive. But there seems to be like this narcissism, or this, I'm better than you and I know more than you do, and just weirdness, because the Ayatollah decided, no, we're gonna stay upstairs. It's nice upstairs. We're gonna stay upstairs and we're gonna have this meeting. We're gonna have breakfast. The reasons he would have made that decision, if he was a logical human being, was that Trump had given him 10 days, not nine. The meeting was in the daytime, and apparently it's not as easy to fly and get to your target when it's morning daylight because of the way the sun is in the desert. And I don't know what it is, but there is a reason that he didn't think that they would attack at that time in the morning. He also, his spies had told them that the generals, the Israeli generals, had all left for the weekend. Okay. What he didn't know is that the generals had left and then snuck back in. Okay. So the amount of stealth on the Americans and on the Israeli side was, again, impressive. But it was the people themselves that put themselves in the danger that they were in, because they thought they were going to live forever. I don't know what it was. It was stupid. Somebody's already bombed you very effectively. They're threatening to do it again. And you decide to have all two, not just the leader, but the two leadership levels underneath them in the same room. So and you don't know that the Israelis and the Americans are watching every move you make. It just was arrogant, I guess I'd call it. So there was all this question in the beginning about this, is that, why did you move when you moved? Well, they moved when they did, because from a military standpoint, the number one target you have is command and control. If you've got the opportunity to take out a command, fracture it into a, nothingness, that was a shot. So in the first 30 seconds of the opening, these people were dead. It was the first target they took. If you still have a feeling of there must have been another way out, I'm with you. I can understand that. I'm a military person. I would have done what they did from the standpoint of the military. It's still ongoing, and it's getting even harder for the what's left of it, of the establishment. Let's put it that way. We've got plenty, apparently we've got plenty of munitions. We're not in any kind of a trouble. But I was watching the TV and there was this woman who had fled Iran. And she said, what most people don't understand is the depravity of these people. He said, she said, there is a law or whatever they call it, that if a virgin woman never had sex, if she dies, she goes directly to heaven. And then she said, and that's why they rape them before they kill them, so they can't get to heaven. That shook me to my core. It was like, whoa, whoa, where is this? Where is this thing? And I'm passing that on to you so that you can see, understand. I think one of the problems that we have is we don't understand evil. How do you get your head wrapped around something that's that crazy, in my opinion? Now, there's one other thing here that I want to kind of like get across to people. I had said for decades that the only way that you would have an efficient federal government or any government is to have a businessman running it, a woman, because in history, I'm a historian, I've got a degree in it, and you could either have people that believed that it was like the politics that drove history. Others thought it was culture, society, religion, that sort of thing. And then there's people like me that said, no, it's the economy. It's always the economy. President Trump is following that view of history. He came along and he stopped all these wars. How did he stop them so efficiently? He had the tariff. He said, if you don't. If you fight each other, I'm going to stop all my business with you and you won't have the money to fight. And, you know, seven different wars were stopped that way through the economic thing. So you got the Palestinian situation with Israel, and Trump goes to the Palestinians, but, you know, beyond that. He goes to the Arabs, friends of his by that time, and says, look it, we can let these people just kill each other off until there isn't any more, or we can help them economically and help ourselves. Because if you're how if you've got if you promote trade, you make money on it. It's as simple as that. And that's what Trump is all about, making America great again, making money so that people don't have an income tax. That's what he's shooting for. He wants to get rid of the income tax. He believes that tariffs will be enough to be able to take that income tax for everybody in the country and say you don't have to pay it anymore. We're very rich. Now, is that and that's not something that's a woo-woo belief. It's he's showing it, he's demonstrating it. So he goes into Venezuela and he takes out the bad leadership with the help of the vice president, okay, and others in Venezuela. When was that? Last month? And already there are billions of dollars in oil sales that is going back to Venezuela and into America. He never went in and did that military operation until he was pretty darn sure that if he just got rid of these people, got rid of the corruption by replacing it with economic vitality, that all the ills would be solved. And I happen to agree with him. I happen to agree with him. As a historian, I saw civilization after civilization falling out of power because they had reached some kind of an economic impasse. They couldn't get beyond it. And then you'd have something happen, and all of a sudden, all this money was coming in. Now, the best example of that is the New World. You had Europe in the throes of the Middle Ages. They were still having a lot more trade than most people understand, but there was a lot of coalescing of power in the society so that you end up with the rich in control and the poor, footing the bill. And then they found the new world, America, South America, all of this potential new income. Now, granted, the explorers initially were grabbing up all the wealth of those nations. It was a wealth grab. But what happened was that this vast influx of money and prosperity resulted in the medieval time frame fading away into the Renaissance period, the Age of Enlightenment. Because there was money. Everybody could get a piece of it. There was more trade going on. So your serfs that had to be a serf because there was no money coming in, there were no jobs, now had a decision. And poof, you got a brand new world. Well, the situation in Venezuela is within a matter of weeks turned around. So that all of the oil that they have access to is coming to the United States. The United States is not just taking the oil. What they're doing is they're taking it into the United States and then refining it and then selling it. And the profits from there, part of it goes to the businesses that are refining and everything else, but part of it goes to the Venezuelan people. So then that money going to the Venezuelan people can be used to build out their infrastructure, to fix all the things that, were destroyed in the last regime, and just boom, you got a wonderful nation. Okay. But both Cuba and China had a real presence in Venezuela. They were taking a lot of oil out of Venezuela, even though the Americans said put an embargo on it. No oil was supposed to flow to these people at all. But they did without flags on the ships. I mean, all those ships that they confiscated was because they were illegal ships to begin with. So they've essentially not just taken the wealth of Venezuela in the form of oil, but they are replenishing the wealth to make more wealth for everybody. So you come to the Iran situation, and it's the same situation, it's the same scenario. He has an economic plan to be able to rebuild Iran so that they can have prosperity just like the Venezuelans are getting now, and because of their trading and probably allowing US businesses to come in and help build, you're going to have America's going to get more money in there from there. Well, now China's lost another oil source. And again, it was sanctioned. So China was paying for it at cut rate pricing, which was one of the reasons that the Iranian economy was shattering. Okay, I mean, I really think about the fact that I'm not sure that the Iranian people have the fundamental necessities of life, i.e., food. They probably got water because all of the strikes that are being reported are laser focused on the Islamic Republic, not on the people. The Islamic Republic is shooting off missiles and drones all over the Middle East, and the targets are civilian airports, some military bases, but they're just shooting them off. Well, why was it that if Iran was this terrible threat to everybody, why was it that the Arabs nations were saying, "Oh, we don't want to get involved in this. We're not doing it. We're not doing it." Why was that? Because they were so terrified of the Iranian Republic. Those are the people that have been supporting Hezbollah and the Houthis and Hamas and other, vehicles of terror all over the world. And, the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates and Syria, all of these different organizations and people, they just wanted to be left alone. We don't want your religion. I mean, that religion is not even, they're Islamic, but they're not, as far as I understand, they're not accepting the religion that says it's okay to, rape a virgin before you murder them. Well, what happened was that when they took out the command centers, there was apparently a order that had been set up to begin with, that if that happened, these various missile launchers and the drone strikes, but particularly the missile launchers, would then put in a computer program into the targeting system. These missiles isn't somebody figuring out, well, how far do I have to go? How much how big of a thing do I have to get? What, none of that. It's all computer controlled. So these people that were now still at the missile launchers said, "Oh God, we can't get a hold of higher command. We're supposed to fire off all these things." And they were going to their friends. Pre-programming. It was like the Republic said, "Well, if we're going to go down, we're going to take everybody with us." And those, like I say, and the computer programs. So you're sitting in Saudi Arabia, and all of a sudden you got missiles coming in at you. You know that those missiles had been pre-programmed. Iran was going to take you down no matter what you did. This is who they were. So now you got a wake up going on in the Arab countries. Oh my God. All the stuff that we did to not make them want to kill us, and they want to kill us anyway, probably because they weren't following the exact religion that the Islamic Republican wanted them to. And the missiles are still going off. There's less and less of them. There's like 90% fewer than they had. The other situation is that so many of these Arab nations that do have oil have to go through the Straits of Hormuz. That's why they had to take out the Islamic, the Iranian Navy, because being the people they are, they would close off. They would shoot up the oil tankers. They wouldn't even hesitate and stop all commerce of oil all over the world. So at the t same time that they're taking out the missile systems and the drones, and then move to the nuclear after having taken out the command and control, the Navy, they went after all the Navy ships. And I don't know how many ships they actually have, but they've taken out, I think I heard, close to 50 of them, because they didn't want the oil trade to collapse. Remember, we're thinking economy is a war tactic, wartime tactic, and it is. So right now we're sitting in a situation where the Arab countries are coming together. They now see that everything that President Trump was talking about, peace through strength, is true. That you can't take yourself off the stage because you're afraid, or because you don't want to rock the boat, or whatever your reason is. It's a learning process for humanity, I think, that goes beyond geopolitical, is something in terms of spirituality, of understanding what it's like to be human and what it's like to be a really bad human. I mean, if you guys are like I am, it's hard to imagine how sick these people are from our viewpoint. So anyway, yes, I could go on, but I'm not going to go on. I wanted to give you the same kind of spiel that my friend asked me to give, because I could give it to her and hopefully have given it to you in a nutshell, so to speak, but an overview of all of the different political, geopolitical things that went into making the situation as we see it right now on the ground. But all my life, it always been like that. And now, in a year and a half, President Trump has come in, and now you look at a future where the Middle East is just coming into its own, coming into a new future. We don't want to mess with your religion, whatever you want to do. We don't even want to mess with your society. All we want to mess with is your economy. We want you to be a trading partner, an industrial partner, a technological development partner. We want the world to come together in order to prosper. Isn't it better to be happy and prosper than to be hateful and full of vengeance and everything else? And that's what I want to leave you with, is that we're very, very fortunate, blessed to have somebody like President Trump and the people he surrounded himself with, the people that are understand economy, understand how to grow an economy, understand geopolitical influences. I mean, it's a beautiful thing if you just let yourself look at it from the standpoint of, this is just common sense. This is your basic moral code that we've agreed to as human beings, at least some of us haven't. And I hope it helps you out to try to get your head around what's really happening there. You don't need the details, but you have to realize that this is a war about economy. It's a war with a lot of other reasons, but the thing that's going to save it is that they're not destroying the oil fields. They're not destroying the oil ports. They're trying to stay away from anything that is industrial that will help the country of Iran come back. And it was a gift from God that they decided to get together for breakfast, because we would not be as far down the road if that hadn't happened. And if President Trump and the Israelis had not acted when they did. So I'm leaving you now. Be safe. We'll see you next time. And just so you know, there is another new show in the Woo Reality series that's also up now. Okay.
Say What? Say What Radio Show. With no agenda. It's always a surprise. But if we're not having fun, we're doing something wrong.